Welcome to the network break. Grab a virtual donut and join us for our weekly review of tech news. We got stories from Infoblox, Juniper, Cisco, AT&T, and more. I'm Drew Conry-Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow. Before we get into the show, I want to thank our sponsors. The Packet Pushers are doing an event in New York with Viptela, and we'll tell you more about that in a little bit. And also thanks to ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes delivers visibility into every network that your organization relies on, from the data center to the cloud, so you can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of network issues wherever they occur. Sign up for an account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers to monitor three locations for free and choose a ThousandEyes t-shirt. Getting into the news, Infoblox, they've announced that they're being bought by the private equity firm Vista Equity Partners for approximately $1.6 billion.
So we've talked about Infoblox a few times over the last year where we started talking about financial results.
Yes.
And I think the first thing that I sort of, when I read this, was like $1.6 billion. I don't get it still, like, after all this time of looking at Infoblox's business model and the competitors to this product, mm-hmm. how you could pay $1.6 billion for that business has really got me beat. That's like an 8x multiple.
Well, apparently
of
so
its revenue.
Yeah, so shareholders are getting $26.50 per common share, according to Bloomberg, and they're also reporting that is a 33% premium over the average closing share price from the last 2 months, so that does seem like quite a high valuation.
It does. It really, really does, actually, and I'm not at all sure. You know, good on Infoblox for finding some poor sucker to pick up the business, especially at that price, is basically where I'm sitting at. The advantage that Infoblox has got is that it's very deeply entrenched in a lot of governments and corporates. And the sense that I get is that people who've got it are going to keep on paying money for it, even if they're not getting much out of it. And so there's a lot of like recurring maintenance revenue in there. Mm-hmm. And so there's some good, you know, you get a chance to take it into private equity so you don't have to report quarter results. You can turn it around, know there's cash flow coming in, and then you can spin it back out in a couple of years. Maybe you're going to do something with the product to modernize it or move beyond its IP address management, like its IPAM roots, and move it more into a security space. So maybe they see it as a security play, because Infoblox has bought a network monitoring company, one of the really big, stable, entrenched old-style late 1990s network monitoring companies. And then they bought the DNS firewalling functionality, which is pretty limited. And by most people's standards, DNS firewall is table stakes these days for a security model. And then, of course, there's the IPAM. So maybe if the company that's bought this, Vista Equity, is going to be able to re-spin it into something else, like maybe boost it up with more security products and see how it goes.
I don't know. My guess is that they will probably cut some staff. They'll run it as lean as they can. Maybe they'll spin out a few things. Maybe they'll load it up with some debt.
But you're not going to get a $1.6 billion in profit out of it.
Well, right? Well, not until you bring it back public again after you try to put a little shine on it. And we'll see what they do to try to put a little bit of that shine on it.
Well, I think you're going to see many more of these private equity deals. And we'll talk more about another one in the next article, right?
That's right.
But the point here is that raising private equity is actually, for the first time in 20 years, is actually very easy, because the cost, the finance, raising finance at the moment is, because government bonds are effectively 0% interest. And in some cases, governments are actually charging companies to lodge billions and billions of dollars with the government, which is effectively where a lot of pension fund money goes. So if you're going to say, like, a private equity company, and you say, like, I can give you a 10% return on this, or even a 5% return, well, you can attract $1 billion pretty easily.
Sure, you can. Yeah, you can borrow money really cheaply. So, you know, you get 5, 6, 7, 8% return on your investment. You're making money.
Oh, you're well into the gravy. And the private equity companies have a pretty good track record of buying up enterprise IT assets, turning them around, and then floating them at a substantial profit shortly thereafter. Now, some of that's due to financial engineering, where they load them up with debt and take fees out of the debt management part, and, you know, transaction fees and all that sort of stuff, and the companies actually come out in worse shape than when they went in. Quite often they actually struggle after they've been spun back out, but that's not really a concern. I think the thing here is that the reason we're going to see many more private equity purchases in the year ahead, you know, and I think there's going to be lots, is that the cost of raising finance is actually so cheap. So if you figure that 5 years ago they would have had to offer 10 to 15% interest rates on the finance, now they're down sort of at the 5% interest rates. That all of a sudden shifts the equation quite substantially.
That's right.
Down. So, you know, the money's almost you know, in practical terms, free. Do you know what I mean?
Close to, yeah.
And so the amount of profit you have to be able to extract from the business in a turnaround is actually much, much less than it was, say, 5-10 years ago. So that's why I think we're going to see a lot more of these, and we've seen so many private equity purchases. There's just a lot of money awash in the investment community looking for a home, and IT assets, especially enterprise IT assets with a low degree of risk because there's recurring revenue attached to the maintenance contracts that you suckers are paying for. Sorry, did I say that out loud? Oh, must be careful. It's just going to sustain these businesses, and they're going to get a return even if they do nothing. So,
and as a side note, Bloomberg, the story notes that Infoblox, they were targeted by an activist investor company called Starboard Value. They happen to hold about 7% of the company shares, so they're probably counting that money saying, nice, nicely done. We did a good job here. Starboard, you may recognize this name because they were also agitating for Yahoo to get sold.
Classic activist investor. Mm-hmm. Come in, make a noise, 33% for what, 3 months' work?
Right.
They probably had to raise
Might have been 6 months' work, maybe six months.
Probably not even, no. They probably targeted the stock, bought a bunch of shares. They probably even bought them highly leveraged as an option and, you know, spent literally almost nothing, and they've got a 30% return for a few months' work. Not bad, eh?
Not bad. I'm in the wrong business.
Some days, yeah, just happens that you've got to have like, you know, tens of millions to be able to make that bet. But
that's right. You're right.
It is a bet. Doesn't always work.
That's true. That's true.
Have a look at the guy who's got billions of dollars worth of Apple shares. What's that guy's name? The guy's a real loudmouth. He keeps saying Apple should bring its money home and pay a dividend, and got nothing. Tim Cook basically went, get out of here. Yeah. So it doesn't always work. Yeah. It's a bet, not a guaranteed thing.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, sticking with private equity, as we mentioned, there's an article in thestreet.com suggesting that Juniper is opening itself to being sold. The article says a private equity buy would probably be the most likely. They have a set of reasons why other tech companies aren't necessarily going to step in.
Yeah, this one is a rumor. This is not at all, you know, for sure. It's a question mark. It's just this one person. I haven't found anybody else who's saying it. So this is right out there on the edge of speculation. But the numbers sort of stack up in that Juniper needs to do something to reinvigorate itself. In particular, Juniper's core customers, and you know, we've talked consistently over the last year or two about Juniper has turned back to focusing on service providers and sort of put the enterprise business on, you know, as not its primary focus, whereas a couple of years ago we were saying our growth is going to be in the enterprise, we're going to dramatically take over the enterprise data center, and then didn't really manage to take advantage of that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And then they had CEO problems, and then they had financial, you know, didn't make the numbers, and the market punished them, and then they had to sort of stop, and then they turned back into the Trio chipset and the MX series of routers. And then, of course, what we're now seeing is that the analyst firms are saying that MPLS revenues are predicted to decline over the next 3 years. So within 3 years, you're going to see a 5% decline in MPLS revenues. So the private WAN game is effectively done. And I've got a presentation here from Juniper itself predicting the end of MPLS. The same survey is talking about software-defined WAN, where they're saying 60% of enterprises will be invested in software-defined WAN within 18 months.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, I am going to take that with a massive dose of salt. I just don't think that – I don't think your average 60% of enterprises can change anything in 18 months, much less their minds, much less a budget, and much less actually like deploy this stuff. I do believe that SD-WAN is compelling, but I find it difficult to believe that 60% of enterprises actually would deploy SD-WAN within 18 months.
Yes, 60% in 18 months, that's not hockey stick growth. That's, I don't know what, a perfectly vertical line.
Yeah, it's not piloting, you know, that's the sort of numbers that Cisco ACI was talking about.
Right.
And, you know, we haven't seen 60% of enterprises deploy SDN, much less Cisco ACI. Right. So
yeah.
I think there's some sort of loading on the survey. The questions might have been, or the audience might have been questionable. But let's take it as, you know, as an intent, yes, SD-WAN's going to – you're going to be hearing a lot more about SD-WAN. And just to back that up, IDC predicted that SD-WAN will grow to $8 billion market in 3 years. Right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I promise you, if 60% of enterprises are taking it up, that's not an $8 billion market. That's much more like a $60 billion market in my view. But anyway, so – you know, SD-WAN is all set to go, and Juniper's not in that game. They have Contrail, and they have a strategy for Contrail as part of enterprises doing service function chaining, which would allow them to deploy a more flexible WAN strategy. But I think what it's signaling is that this old idea of static, long-term, fixed, guaranteed bandwidth private WAN contracts is over, right? enterprises don't want to sign a 5 or 10 year contract when they're looking at, when they believe the current fashion, you know, technology fashion is to move to the public cloud. Why would I sign a 10 year or a 5+5 WAN bandwidth contract with a carrier when I'm going to be in the cloud within 2 years, if you believe all the hype?
So a couple of things then here. If MPLS revenue is expected to decline, that would essentially hurt Juniper because its own big telco customers may not be buying as much gear. Is that the connection?
Yeah, that's right. As if the revenues decline, then the carriers either have to pay less for their assets or turn to alternate suppliers. So if they stick with their existing suppliers, they're going to have to pay less for their hardware. In a growing market where revenues and profits are growing, then you can afford to spend more on your assets. In a shrinking market, you start to squeeze your suppliers. So inherently, Cisco's revenues, Juniper's revenues, all the WAN carrier backbone stuff is going to have to shrink.
So the big red blinking light here that emerges to me is, hey, maybe Juniper should buy one of these SD-WAN startups.
Yeah, they could do that. But, you know, if you've sort of dabbled in the enterprise, do you think the enterprise would still regard Juniper as a positive company if they've sort of, you know, in the enterprise, out of enterprise, in the enterprise, out of the enterprise? Or what's their, you know, if you do a test
of
the market,
I guess because Juniper, you know, has a reputation in the WAN, and that's where SD-WAN sits. It's, you know, not a data center play necessarily. So I, you know, and if they buy a hot startup that does a good product, I don't think customers will really care all that much. And if they're really 60% of enterprises buying this product, why wouldn't they buy a company? Yeah.
Well, there's WAN and there's WAN. There's companies who run their own MPLS backbone, so they lay an MPLS over some other service providers.
Yeah.
And that business, the idea of an enterprise running an MPLS overlay is going to be replaced by SD-WAN, I believe. And you're not going to be buying MX routers for that. You're going to look to, you know, Viptelas, Telaris, Telo IPs, you know, any one of those many different SD-WAN vendors because of the application and the visibility tooling that you get.
Mm-hmm.
And the flexibility, like the actual, you know, if I configure this, this is what's going to happen. You know, that ability to recognize traffic at the edge. At the very best, MPLS can say any traffic coming from this IP address matching this ACL can do this. That's not flexible. That's 10-year-old.
Right.
You know, that's last two generation old technology. That's not where the future's going to be.
Right.
So, you know, if they can start routing IP packets in the core, but increasingly we're seeing optical eat away at the core. You know, instead, why would you install 100 gigabit Ethernet and try and route IP packets at terabit performance when you could just switch optical in the core?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think Juniper has to do something to turn itself around. And I do believe that the focus on Contrail is definitely working. There are carriers who are very interested in that. But is that enough for the investors on Wall Street when they're looking around at all these companies going private and, you know, Dell and HPE selling off its non-core businesses and slimming down, and Cisco's out doing partnerships, and, you know, what's Juniper doing? I think they're going to be under real pressure, yes.
I think so. Well, we'll definitely be keeping an eye on Juniper going forward to see what the fall brings for them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, moving on. Just quickly touch on this. Yahoo reported one of the biggest user data breaches on record, 500 million accounts stolen back in 2014. Do we care?
Well, it's the biggest ever breach of accounts, so just by the number of accounts. So Yahoo has just scored a world record for
not,
all the
not
wrong
the record
reasons.
You want to set. Yeah.
Not the record you want to set. My immediate reaction was, hey, someone's using those Yahoo accounts all of a sudden. Yeah, hey. Good for them. You know, at least someone's using them, because I sure as hell ain't. I think the only time I use it is to log into Flickr. And I stopped using Flickr because it was so weird, like it's so Yahoo that I just couldn't stand it anymore. So I'm not too sure that anybody actually cares. Judging from the, you know, if 500,000 accounts have 500 million accounts have been compromised, there doesn't seem to be a lot of blowback yet.
Not yet, and it apparently happened in 2014. Who knows what the fallout has been?
Yeah, I've been watching some tweets suggesting that, you know, the rumors have been swirling since 2012, so maybe it was even known before then.
It's possible. It seems that the one potential fallout here, apparently Verizon, who's in talks to buy Yahoo, didn't really find out until just a couple of days ago, and they don't seem very happy about it. We'll see how this affects the acquisition going forward.
It's going to be bad because, you know, people are just going to be like down on Yahoo. There's always a negative impact from this sort of stuff. It's going to be temporary, and it's not very real. I don't think most people even care. there's been so many breached accounts by now that it's like, so what?
Right. And it wasn't credit card data or anything. It was just, it was usernames, passwords, phone numbers, date of birth, that kind of stuff. I mean, that can be used to perpetrate identity theft. So it's serious, but yeah, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. It's kind of like one of these things that, you know, there's no penalty for this. I've said it many a times, you know, how many credit card breaches have happened over the last 5 years and those companies have gone on to just be just fine. Thank you very much.
There may be a little bit of fallout. I heard a story on NPR this morning talking about California has some pretty stringent breach notification laws. And if Yahoo's been sitting on this for a while, there may be some legal fallout there. We'll see what happens.
Yep. If Yahoo wasn't dead before, this should probably kill it. Seems like
poor Yahoo. Poor Yahoo. I will say I've had a Yahoo email account for, God, probably 15 years, and it came in handy when I had to recently travel to China and couldn't check Gmail because Google gets blocked, but Yahoo came through, so tip of the hat to Yahoo for that, but also worried about my password now. I got to go change it.
Interesting days.
Yes, indeed. All right, moving on. HPE and Docker, they have announced the availability of HPE servers with Docker Engine, quote, pre-configured, integrated, and validated. HPE and Docker announced earlier that they were going to offer this, and now it's out. It's available. You can go get it.
So to me, this is that hyper-convergence trend that is, you know, enterprises don't want to build their own hardware and everybody wants to be in the cloud. So the reaction to the cloud is to converge the hardware and have specially blessed servers that are, you know, prepackaged and ready to go so that the enterprise can just go and buy a bundle and start focusing on its building up its Docker skills before it then goes and buys independent servers and runs them on top of normal servers. So, this makes a sense if you believe in that sort of business model. I do ultimately believe that this idea of buying Docker ready servers as a custom package is a short-term game. It doesn't seem to make sense in the long term because the value of building a private cloud is that you use servers to run software and the two are run independently of each other. You shouldn't have to say, oh, these are my servers that just run Docker and these are my servers that run VMware and especially blessed to run VMware. And over here is my Oracle, especially blessed to run. That's not a private cloud. Right? Right. So this idea of buying, you know, matched hardware to your applications makes zero sense to me in the long term.
Yeah, I agree. I think this seems more like a short-term play. There's a lot of excitement and attention to Docker. I don't know if there's a lot of deployment yet. So HPE is going to step in and say, we'll hold your hands as you get into this crazy, weird Docker thing. You know, we've got the blessed integration. We can provide you to technical support and consulting, get a little green coming our way. So yeah, I think it's a short-term, let's take advantage of a trend here kind of play. Long-term, I can't see people wanting to buy blessed integrated Docker on specific servers.
Yeah, I think it's a phase that we go through. You know, there was a time many years ago when we went through something similar. You know, you would Windows NT certified hardware. You know, you buy your Windows Intel inside and, you know, all that. And then eventually we just stop caring and we run Linux on anything. And it's a temporary thing. I don't think it's a and it doesn't make sense in the long term because what happens if you're running, got some VMware servers and then you want to run Docker on them? Do you go and buy new servers and throw them out? No, you just,
get on with it.
Exactly.
All right, let's take a quick break to talk about our sponsor today, Viptela. The Packet Pushers are putting on a live event in New York with Viptela. And Greg, you can tell us a little bit more about it.
Yes. So you might remember last year we did a live podcast with Viptela in New York around about the time of the ONUG conference. So we're not sure on the details yet. It's all coming together right as we speak. But either on Monday or the Tuesday night on the 24th or the 25th of October, we'll be recording a live podcast with Viptela in New York, and it'll be closely located to the ONUG conference. So it'll be down there somewhere. We would love for you to come along and hear us and join us to listen to the live podcast. So in a few days, we'll announce the details. Keep an eye on the Packet Pushers blogs or on our Twitter accounts where we'll publish details to the links and so forth. But a couple of things I wanted to say. One of the things is that over the last year or so, we've done a couple of these events, these live events with Viptela, and they do a great event. They're not overly offensive. You want to come along. You can meet some of the Viptela people and talk about their products and say thanks to them for them. Definitely worth doing. They've got great products. And you can also meet us and you can meet other people like you, most importantly. So people like you who might want to, you know, talk about war stories or share notes on products that you're looking at or talk to other people in the industry, come along. So what we'll be doing is getting together early, having a few drinks, having a conversation. You know, Ethan and I will be there if you think that it's important to catch up with us. Then we'll be recording a live podcast, which is usually quite entertaining and quite useful. Viptela's always done customers, not product information. So it won't be a pitch. It's usually customers telling us about their actual stories. And then afterwards, we'll be having a few more drinks and you'll be able to chat to the people around you. So stay tuned for more details. As I said, follow us on Twitter, check us up with us on our Facebook page, the Packet Pushers Facebook page, or on the LinkedIn. We have a page on LinkedIn as well. And as soon as we have the details, they'll be posted there. And also on the blog, we'll have a blog post that tells you where to go and how to sign up for the event. You will have to sign up, because we do want to filter and make sure it's customers. But otherwise, yes, looking forward to seeing you in New York if you can make it around the 24th or the 25th of October.
And I remember the event last year, they had good beer and good food. And there's a kind of energy that comes when you're recording something live, especially after you and Ethan have had a couple of drinks. There's a crowd there. There's a little bit of energy. It just has a different feel than sort of a podcast recorded in a studio. So if you can make it, come check it out.
Yeah, no more shots during the podcast.
No more shots. Okay, getting back into the news. Cisco and Salesforce are announcing a partnership around business collaboration and IoT. There's a story in ZDNet talking about how the companies are going to develop products that integrate Cisco Spark, that's its Slack-like collaboration platform, and WebEx into Salesforce's SaaS products.
Yeah, so first of all, I went, oh, what? Why? Where does Cisco and Salesforce? And then, of course, you start to realize it's around collaboration and IoT. So it's about software. It's not about hardware. It's not about infrastructure. This is the new part of Cisco, which has got nothing to do with your routers or your servers or your storage units. It's the part of Cisco that has Jasper. So if you have a bunch of IoT devices all around the world and you've got your Jasper platform, you've still got customers to manage. Salesforce is your customer management platform for a lot of companies. So having integration between these two platforms makes sense. It's all cloudy, wowdy, wowdy. So off we go. So,
yeah, I think the idea is that, you know, if you're a user and you're trying to contact a customer and you've got Spark, you can just click on their profile information and set up a text, set up a video call, whatever, all the nice things that Cisco offers. So it's about making it easier to reach out to customers. On the IoT front, Cisco has Jasper. That's its SaaS platform for building IoT services. They're going to integrate with an IoT cloud from Salesforce. I didn't know Salesforce had an IoT cloud, but it turns out they're building out a service option as well where they'll suck in all kinds of IoT data to make it easier for you to sell stuff to your customers.
Yeah, and that's sort of where it is. So it's about Cisco Spark. So those of you who've looked at Cisco Spark and you think that that's a really great thing, then you could start to think about how you integrate your contact centers. So you could have Cisco Spark for your people who are in your call centers to handle customer management using Cisco Spark and integrating with Salesforce. But also in terms of Jasper, which is the tool we've talked about, integrating Salesforce Cloud with that. So it's not an infrastructure partner. The thing is, of course, here is that when elephants dance, small people get crushed. I'd be very cautious to see how this evolves. As I said, partnerships don't always seem to work out the way that customers want. So I'd be waiting to see how this works out over time, as our next story will highlight.
It will. And before we get there, I just want to say Cisco has been making a lot of effort to do partnerships. We had talked over the past couple of weeks about their work with Apple, you know, around integrating iOS devices on Cisco networks. So this seems like a strong push for Cisco to really work with partners to integrate themselves outside of the routing and the switching and the networking hardware, get that sort of customer face on their applications.
Yeah, I just want to be careful, and you know, I'm fairly cynical about these partnerships.
Oh, of course, and the next story will highlight that very well.
And I just want to, you know, and so these partnerships, if you're as a customer, you want to look at them and go, let's just wait and see how that pans out before, you know, let plenty of water go under that bridge before we dive in and commit assets and resources to these types of things.
Yes. Speaking of which, Network World is reporting that Cisco is winding down its InterCloud initiative. That was a program where partners would build infrastructure as a service offerings using Cisco equipment, and then all these clouds could be interconnected. Surprise, surprise, trying to build public cloud services on top of premium priced infrastructure didn't really pan out.
Where's my spreadsheet with predictions? So the idea of building many small clouds and then federating them together, which is the primitive behind InterCloud, I think was always predicated to fail, but it did actually manage to sell a lot of assets. So I'm sure it's been a great success for Cisco. There's been many customers who've bought many tens and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Cisco products and built private clouds that they attempted to sell to people and probably didn't get very far. If you remember back far enough, Cisco allocated $1 billion to the InterCloud project. I wonder how much of it spent before it burned this out.
That is a good question. I don't know. I would love to know that number, though.
So you could be looking at anything up to $1 billion down the tubes here, which is a fairly substantial failure. Now, I don't believe that Cisco would have got this far down the pipe, would have spent all that money to get by the time it got that far. But, you know, for those companies who have put their great efforts into these, and there are carriers all over the world, telcos, service providers of various types who built out big Cisco infrastructures built on this model, you know, it's really not worked out well for them. And I think probably the takeaway from this is that a lot of customers just believe that everything that Cisco sells is going to be great for you and dive right in because Cisco is going to be behind it. And I think the lesson to be learned from Intercloud is don't believe that everything that Cisco does is the right thing. You need to be aware and careful and looking carefully into the future before you dive into these types of things. You should stand back as far as possible if you can.
I feel like the concept of federated clouds, that's a good one because we complain all the time about vendor lock-in. Going to the public cloud is essentially the ultimate lock-in. So, you know, having a federated cloud, I think where you could actually move your data and your workloads from one cloud to another sort of ameliorates that Hotel California aspect of public cloud services where you can check in any time, but you can never leave. The execution here, though, obviously didn't work out.
So hybrid cloud, I'm still a believer in my prediction that there's
I'm not even talking about hybrid cloud with from private
to
public,
cloud is
but
a
federated
cloud
between you know different public providers.
The basic premise behind this is that if you were running instances in this piece of intercloud and you could move it to that intercloud, right, there's not enough bandwidth in the world to make that sort of data movement at scale work. And I don't think there ever will be. You will always end up being, as you say, Hotel California with a public cloud. So whether you go into Amazon or Azure or Google or any of the other clouds, you're going to be stuck. You're going to be trapped to some level unless you dumb down. I think the second thing is that what we're seeing is that public cloud really isn't about ES. So it's not about running your VMs for you. That's not a public cloud. What public clouds want to do is run your apps.
Yes.
They want to sell you databases and PaaS, platforms as a service. They want just your raw code and they're going to run it for you. They're going to give you storage. They're not going to give you LUNs, if you know what I mean, or, you know, a couple of gigabytes of, you know, VM space to boot a VM. The real value is in the value add further up the stack where the differentiation and the customer retention is higher.
Absolutely.
And I think ES was always going to be that. So it was always obvious that ES in the public cloud didn't make a whole lot of sense. Amazon started there because they had to build ES to be able to build a PaaS, to be able to build software as a service. So the line was always linear, I think. So, yeah, it makes sense for Cisco to move on from intercloud, but it was always going to be doomed to failure. And I think I've said as much right from the very beginning for the last 3 or 4 years.
All right, we'll dig up the spreadsheet and make a note, a little hooray for you.
Russia's tickets off self, yay, or something like that. Sad. I mean, it is disappointing when these things don't work. I mean, there are people who've bet careers, or you know, maybe their own position within their organizations is now tarnished. So I'm disappointed for them, but you know, that's just the way of these things. And you know, on the other hand, kudos to Cisco for trying something. Right? They had to do something to react.
Yeah, it is Silicon Valley. You're supposed to fail fast. So move on.
Yep, that's it. I guess. As long as you're not the fail part.
Well, So sticking with clouds, Information Week's reporting on a Gartner projection that says public cloud market will be worth $208 billion by the end of this year. That's an increase of 17.2% over 2015.
That just doesn't ring true, does it?
I don't know. What about it doesn't ring true to you?
Well, they say AWS is generating $10 billion a year in revenue. Mm-hmm. So let's say it's $20 billion. Let's say it grows by 100% this year and $20 billion. There's a bit of a gap between $20 billion and $208 billion. Where's the other $180 billion? Is that like Amazon is something like 10 times bigger than every other public cloud provider?
Well, I guess it depends on how you count public cloud. If you're also looking at software as a service, then there's a whole bunch of other organizations you throw in there.
What, like Salesforce and Oracle with its Oracle public cloud? Sorry, I can't stop laughing.
maybe not Oracle, but Salesforce for sure.
Yeah, you'd have to see the report. Another headline looks cool. Doubtful that there's much useful information in here.
Okay, then we will leave it there. Greg, you found a story about narrowband IT. That's an emerging cellular standard for low power wide area connectivity, obviously tied to IoT. What's going on here?
So narrowband IoT is, I think I talked about it before, there's a couple of different pending implementations, and it's part of the 5G. And what we're actually seeing is now the people are taking the narrowband, the concepts of, you know, we need low power, low bandwidth, ultra low device cost, and they're backfitting it to existing standards, so 3G and 4G. So what we're actually seeing is a raft of technologies, and it's all called narrowband IoT as a sort of generic term. I'll put a link into the show notes to the article, but I'll also put a link into the Wikipedia article, which links to this as well, which sort of gives you some insight. Now, just keep in mind there are competing standards here, but basically what you're looking at is a maximum bandwidth of 1 meg and at a lowest speed bandwidth of 256K. So you, really low bandwidth. The advantage of low bandwidth is that you can actually use very, very little power.
Right.
You're also looking at like half duplex technologies. Half duplex, again, uses even less power, but there's also a low latency mode, which is in the LTE terms, LTE Cat 1, which is 5 megabits per second up, 10 megabits per second down. Uses two-channel MIMO and is also full duplex. So you can actually get quite low latency but very low speeds, right? 5 megs isn't much in these things. So what we're seeing, I think, is this story about new types of mobile networking to support new types of networking capabilities, which normally we've talked about, you know, more bandwidth solves all the problems. But if you want to have low power, what we've always known is that low bandwidth is low power.
Right.
And, you know, single SISO, single antenna instead of MIMO, which is multi-antenna, multi-channel type stuff. So, but I think the real transition perhaps, and that's what this article is highlighting, is the ATRI retrofitting those to the 3G. So the 3G PP standards body is actually saying, here's some narrow band. So the NB and NB-IoT stands for narrow band. Here's some technology being retrofitted, being standardized. I know Nokia has made several blog posts, and so has Ericsson, saying we're adding this functionality to our technology. Come and buy some upgrades so you can have the narrowband. There are entire countries who have upgraded, places like Norway and a couple of countries in Asia who've just enabled this on all their towers to suddenly start supporting this type of stuff. And if you start thinking about, you know, Apple Watches or, you know, personal devices that are connected to this, just 256K, that's enough to send up heartbeat info.
Yeah, that's exactly what this kind of use case is for, where a low amount of bandwidth isn't really an issue if you're talking about small sensors like, you know, an electrical meter on somebody's house that can just report back to the, you know, to the utility. You're not pumping out a lot of data there.
Yeah, once a day, it wakes up, transfers that.
Yeah, or sensors on, you know, some farm equipment or, you know, some other industrial IoT use. That's what this is about. So low bandwidth isn't really an issue. It really is about power, because part of the thing of installing all these sensors all over the place, having to roll out a truck to replace the batteries, you want to do that as few times as possible.
And a lot of devices. So
yes.
The actual protocols are now devices, you know, are built to support thousands or tens of thousands of devices in a single cell. So they've optimized the radio and the way that the antennas work and all that. So all the technology that goes in behind this that you may or may not know about, but most likely don't, they're all optimized for this, you know. Instead of like mobile phones, which have a fairly low density per cell, you're going to have these massive densities per cell.
Gotcha.
And also got to work alongside of existing stuff. So, you know, not as easy as it sounds.
Right. The article we're referencing says commercial deployments are expected in 2017. We'll have both those links. You can go check it out if you're interested.
Mm-hmm.
One more story before we take another break. The largest ever DDoS attack may be going on, and it's going after Brian Krebs. You may know him. He's a well-known security researcher. He blogs at Krebs on Security. He's broken a lot of stories about breaches. He's raised the ire of a lot of folks who don't like having their business exposed. So I guess apparently someone is really trying to take his site offline.
Yeah, last I heard, his site is currently down, but the company that does his DDoS mitigation is actually just putting up a blank page, probably while they mitigate it. But last I heard, I've been following some tweets on the topic, he's actually peaked at 720 gigabits per second on his one site, which is just extraordinary. Now, you may not be a target like Brian Krebs is, because he has all sorts of problems. But the thing that you want to note here is, and I think I've said this many times before, you cannot handle a DDoS attack at your home site. You have to have an externally, either take nothing, like there's no point in putting a DDoS protection unit on your premises, be in a colo where they have a managed DDoS protection service, or have a managed service that actually exists in the internet, and use that. You just can't do DDoS yourself. So don't even fool yourself that you can. I just wanted to highlight that. A lot of people make that mistake. Because, you know, the average size of a DDoS is now 60 gigabits per second. And there's not too many enterprises who have 60 gigabits per second of bandwidth on-prem.
Yeah, well, that's too bad for Brian. We hope it gets resolved. But wow, that's another record that you don't want your name associated with. I guess there's the silver lining is that there's publicity here, but not if people can't actually read your blog.
Sure, yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break to talk about ThousandEyes. As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. That's a huge problem if you're running critical applications, websites, and services. And that's where ThousandEyes comes in. They give you visibility into every network that your company relies on, so your corporate network, the internet, your service providers, all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. And from these vantage points, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight, including BGP routing and DNS. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems like device faults, hijacks, route leaks, DNS failures. You can also share this data and insights with your vendors and your customers to help resolve problems faster. And ThousandEyes has a special offer just for Packet Pushers listeners. You can sign up for a free account at www.thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, it's network intelligence you can see. Thanks, ThousandEyes, for being a sponsor. Okay, back to the news. We were talking about IoT for a little bit. Now we're talking about some wireless connectivity. AT&T, they put out a press release on Project AirGig. It's designed to send gigabit speed wireless signals around low power lines. Details in the press release are kind of scant, but the general idea is to deploy low-cost radio with antenna on top of utility poles, and they'll send wireless signals that travel near but not through power lines. The object is to get wireless connectivity to underserved areas faster and also, of course, reduce the need to roll out dedicated fiber.
Yeah, so you're putting wireless equipment next to a high voltage power lines or any sort of power lines is like a big no-no, right? Because the RF that comes off the power lines generally interferes with the wireless. So if they've come up with something here that can work, but unfortunately this technology is so patented that it's probably unworkable.
Yeah, why is that?
I'll quote from the article. AT&T has more than 100 patents or patent applications supporting this new technology and other access technologies. Okay, we're done here. No one's going to get involved with a proprietary wireless technology unless they, you know, do something. Some neat tricks though, right? They've used low-cost plastic antennas because normally antennas have to be metal to radiate the signal. And the last thing you don't want next to
to your high-power electrical lines is metal.
That's right, yeah. And I think they're also using the power lines as well to generate millimeter wave signals that can be used for 4G LTE and 5G, 5 gig multibit. So if they can get somebody to go out there and pick up this technology, well, yay. But I remain a little bit dubious that, you know, this is going to be very big. People don't want to get stuck in proprietary technologies anymore, even if it's unique and allows you to reuse your existing, you know, poles on the ground. They're saying it could be very good for rural and underserved because you can just pop them on top of the power lines and basically away you go.
Right.
But, you know, proprietary technology is not a feature. If you're going into rural and underserved parts of the world, they don't want proprietary technology. They want cheap, low-cost, high-volume technologies.
Right. I don't know, maybe AT&T is feeling some pressure from Google because we know that Google, in addition to rolling out Google Fiber, they're also experimenting with wireless broadband connectivity as well.
Yeah, maybe, but I, you know, if you're going to deal with rural and underserved, that's a cheap market. The revenue has to be right. And patented technology, I'm not 100% convinced that that's going to stack up unless AT&T develops a moral backbone.
Well, they do. I think there's government pressure in the U.S. There are regulations that say they have to provide service to rural areas. At least they did for telephone. I don't know if that's applied to broadband, but, you know, maybe they'll see some regulatory benefit to rolling this out.
Maybe it's only going to work in the U.S. market where rural and underserved means government supported.
Right.
So in other words, there's massive subsidies coming in from the U.S. government to do something about rural America, which means it actually doesn't have to be for profit. It's just politics.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah. And, you know, not the sort of thing that you're going to see in rural Africa, say.
Not necessarily. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's why Google's experimenting with balloons and such.
Yeah, there's my cynical button again. That's all the way.
This cynical button goes to 11.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All All right, a couple more news stories before we wrap it up. Open Daylight, that's the open source SDN controller overseen by the Linux Foundation. They've announced the fifth version of the project called Boron. The features include a new project called Cardinal that exposes the health of the controller device, so it can track your memory, CPU usage, etc. And it actually, they created an SNMP MIB, so you can monitor the controllers via traditional SNMP environments. I had a briefing with ODL about this. Something I learned from them, I'd always sort of put Open Daylight in an enterprise bucket, but apparently they're getting a lot of uptake and interest from telcos and service providers, and that includes code contributions. So AT&T, Telefonica, China Mobile, they're all contributing code back to the project.
This is something you know more about than me. It's good to see that Open Daylight is moving forward and continuing to get code out the door. And also very interesting to see telcos involved. Now, we saw vendors involved for a long period of time. IBM remains a very significant contributor to Open Daylight, if I remember rightly. So, you know, seeing the telcos and service providers start to get into contributing code is actually quite interesting. And that we may actually have a, you know, controller around which we all want to group around. I do see Open Daylight still as a long-term, like a 5 or 10 year play. It's like Linux. It'll take 5 or 10 years before it gets to where we all need it to be.
So that's the messaging actually coming out of Open Daylight, what they were telling Ethan and I in our briefing. So they really see the adoption by the telcos and the service providers as saying, this is really helping to make the code base stable. And now they can, now that they're getting it into this position, they feel like they're at a tipping point where they can start directing it more toward the enterprise, saying we've got strong, stable code base, we've got use cases, we've got folks contributing, we've got a lively, vibrant community. Enterprises can now come in, or service, or VARs and so on, to say we can take Open Daylight and build some kind of service that we can then sell to the enterprise. So it's a feature, not a bug, that it's had the telco adoption.
Over time, I think that ODL will be the controller that most of us use.
Well, there's also Onos, the Open Network Operating System, which is a controller slash sort of orchestration system, also in the Linux Foundation, also aimed at carriers. So a little bit of conflict there, but I think there's room for everybody.
I do. And I also, you know, it's just going to take time for these things to work out. I do ultimately see that buying a controller from a vendor is not the way you want to be. You want to be independent. You want to have standards. And the only way to have a standard in, you know, in the same way we talk about Kubernetes. So Kubernetes orchestrates containers. And the advantage of Kubernetes is that it's open. There's hundreds of contributors in the project. It's messy and it's noisy and it's blah, blah, blah. But at least everybody's running Kubernetes and it's becoming like the dominant way of orchestrating containers.
Yes.
We need the same thing for SDN. We need to have one basic form. And the networking market moves a lot slower than containers does. So this is going to take years and years and years. I mean, it's only been 5 years since SDN started. And we're still – and everything in networking takes 10 years. So, you know, don't think that it's all over and you should be going and buying a proprietary controller from a vendor. I think in the long term, we need to have a standard core of shared functionality like we did with routing protocols in the SDN layer. But it's still years away. That's no reason. You shouldn't be waiting for ODL to get there. You should be deploying some other thing, knowing that it's proprietary and closed, but gives you the functionality that you need to get your business innovation happening and so forth, and then come back to it later on.
Or the other thing is go get ODL right now, put it in a lab, start playing with it, start getting comfortable with it, get involved. One of the good things about being involved in open source is that if you start to contribute code, then you get things that you want.
Okay. I think that most of us, in reality, most people in the enterprise just don't have the time and resources to
that's
do
true.
The point is that most of the people working in enterprise networks have barely got time to just buy equipment, because it's so complicated to work out what the purchase order in terms of licensing and
sure.
new products coming from vendors, just that basic day-to-day stuff. They're not going to have time to sit in labs and futz with it, I don't think.
All right. I guess I was being a little too optimistic.
Well, you know, it'd be nice to believe these things, but, you know, the reality is that we don't.
Another story, you found this as a piece about Centec Networks getting an E-series round of funding. I don't know who Centec Networks is or what they do.
Centec makes silicon. So what most people think of as silicon comes from Broadcom, but there's many companies that actually make switching silicon for switches. And Centec is one company that I met at Interop 2 years ago. They focus pretty much exclusively on, up until now, on low-end silicon. So they focused on 1 gigabit per second, sort of low bandwidth, low power sort of stuff. So rather at the cheaper end of the market. And what we're actually looking at here is a $47 million financing money raised in China from Chinese investors to build a next generation of silicon. So what we're now looking at is probably 10, 25, 50, 100 gig silicon. And it'll be we'll look forward to seeing that come down the line as silicon, a new version of silicon that we can have. I believe that we need more than just Broadcom providing us the switching silicon, because we need choices there. I don't think we need custom silicon, but what we do need is a range of switching ASICs that we can choose according to our needs. And sometimes it might be based on cheapest price, where we want low bandwidth, low functionality, you know, or mature silicon that's stabilized and low cost to produce. And then we also want high speed modern silicon. We need a range of possible choices, and Cavium and, you know, what Barefoot's done with Tofino with their flexible pipelines, that's going to be used for different functionalities. So I'm very keen to see this happen, and congratulations to Centek for bringing this up.
All right, more competition. That's a good thing. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
They can find me on the packet pushes these days. I'm moving away from writing at ethereummind.com. So come and visit me and my articles at packetpushes.net. Follow me on the Twitters as at ethereummind.
And I'm Drew Conway Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I also blog at packetpushers.net. Thanks to our sponsors, Viptela and Thousand Eyes. And thanks to you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share a link with your colleagues. And please check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find out how to sign up for those at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.